Jeff Dyer lived aboard the aircraft carrier George H.W. Bush for 2 weeks as a kind of writer in residence. Because he's a Brit and was possibly both the tallest and oldest man on board, he never quite faded into the background. But his book, Another Great Day at Sea, does manage to capture the experience of being at sea with the U.S. Navy in a small and maybe ideal version of America. The book is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it brings Jeff Dyer back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Great to be here.
Considering that you're a finicky eater, you describe yourself as such, a light sleeper, a germphobe, you're noise sensitive, hate the smell of gasoline, don't want to sleep in a room with other people, why did you choose an aircraft carrier to live on and write about?
Well, but before I answer that, I've just got to, stop this vicious misrepresentation of me. I was not the oldest person on the aircraft carrier. I was the second oldest person.
Who was the oldest, the captain?
There was a dentist on board who was a few years older than me. So, yeah, out of 5,000 people, I was the anyway. So, yeah.
Were the other choices? Prison or a Chinese factory?
I'll give you a little bit of background. This writer, Alain de Botton, had been writer in residence at Heathrow Airport in London, wrote a small book about it, had a great time. So he had this idea of setting up, getting writers to be in residence in unusual places. Every college has a writer in residence. And with that in mind, he said, is there anywhere you'd like to go? And really quickly, I decided it was crazy to go anywhere that I might end up in the normal course of my life. The more closed the world, the better. And I had two sort of choices. I thought, on the one hand, maybe, because I'd been very interested in the U.S. Marine Corps, I thought maybe Camp Pendleton or Fort Pendleton, whatever it's called, down in San Diego. Either that or an aircraft carrier, a U.S. aircraft carrier.
Inspired by the models you used to make as a kid and by all the movies you used to watch?
Pretty much, yeah. You know, I had a long-running interest in military aircraft. And so in the end, I said, if you can get me on an aircraft carrier, that would be great, thinking it wouldn't happen. And then 6 months later, he says, okay, pack your bags, you're on your way to Bahrain.
You live in the United States, you live in California, so do you think of yourself as an American? Would you have considered going on a British aircraft carrier? Does being British give you a different perspective?
Yeah, it was very specific that I wanted to be on an American aircraft carrier for two reasons. One, very simple, our bankrupt country, we haven't got an aircraft carrier
anymore.
No
more?
No. I mean, there's one, we've got to kind of make...
What happens if the Falklands act up again?
Well, yeah, then we're... I've got a feeling that there's a pretty widespread feeling now that we're thinking, God, we're paying, we'd like to get rid of those, that we'd like to sell them to Argentina in a way. So we haven't got one. And also, I mean, I really did want to be on an American aircraft carrier because I couldn't bear the kind of class nature of the hierarchy you get on a British aircraft.
Were you surprised that the US Navy was willing to accommodate you?
I was amazed at the ease with which I got on board, because I emphasize, just in case I know the security forces are listening, I'm here on a visa now, and I know how much paperwork there is to just get a visa to be here. So when I saw de Botton a couple of weeks ago, I said to him, it was incredibly easy, that, wasn't it? And he said, oh no, it was the most difficult thing I've ever been involved in. Behind the scenes, there was all sorts of vetting going on. And I was the beneficiary of the way that there is actually another Jeff Dyer, a respectable Financial Times journalist. And apparently halfway through the negotiating process, this high-ranking member of the Navy called de Botton and said, there are two of these Jeff Dyers. Please tell me it's the Financial Times one.
And you spell your names the same.
We spell our names
the same.
You've
both been on the show.
Yeah.
I get confused sometimes.
Yeah. So apparently right until the last minute, they were under the impression it was this altogether more respectable journalist going on board.
Were any restrictions imposed on you? You wanted some. For example, you asked for a single occupancy bedroom.
Yeah, that was my great achievement, getting a room to myself. And initially, when they said that I would be that myself and the photographer, Chris Steele Perkins, each of these residences, the writer is accompanied by a Magnum photographer, they said we'd be escorted all the time by Ensign Newell. And I thought, so they're just trying to chaperone us, and effectively that it's a bit of pre-censorship. In fact, I realised the reason for this is, A, to avoid, there's lots of chances of hurting yourself on an aircraft carrier, so it's just to make sure we didn't hurt ourselves. There are all sorts of places they didn't want us to go for quite sensible reasons, the reactor room. But actually, it was mainly, he was with us mainly just so we didn't get lost. If I hadn't been escorted round by him, I'd probably still be on that boat now looking for the exit door.
Because it's so huge?
It's so huge, and everywhere looks pretty much the same. It's just this endless succession of stairways and walkways.
Had you spent any extended time at sea before? Are you good? Do you have good sea legs, or do you get seasick?
Do you know, the Arabian Gulf where we were, it was flat as a pancake. So at the sea, so there was no scope for getting seasick. I've always hated the idea of being on boats. You know, sometimes on the Thames they'll have these all-night parties on a boat, and I've never wanted to go on them because I just hate the idea that you're there for the duration. So in a sense, any kind of ship is inherently a prison ship, which has never appealed.
You have to arrive by plane because it's an aircraft carrier.
That's correct, and that was very, very dramatic. We were on this sort of, I don't know, 12 or 16 person propeller plane, took off from Bahrain, and we came down and to land on the carrier. But on the first approach, we missed the arresting wire, so straight up again.
Happen often?
It's not at all uncommon. There are just three wires, and they're maybe, I don't know, 20 feet apart. So there's a good chance that you'll have to go up and round again.
You are on a propeller plane.
Yeah.
But jets also land on the aircraft carriers. Does that make it more complicated?
Oh, my word, yeah. What I hadn't realized, actually, I assumed that as with a normal passenger plane, the plane will come into land and go more and more slowly, just above stalling speed. What I hadn't realized is that in case the plane misses the arresting wire, it accelerates to full power just before touching the deck. So at the moment, if the hook gets the arresting wire, the plane is in a state of maximum determination not to be arrested.
And that's why they wouldn't let you bring along a notebook or a computer.
Well, they didn't want me to have a... that's right, because when you land, you know, you're brought to a stop very, very abruptly in about... in about 1.5 seconds, I think.
My guest is Jeff Dyer, G-E-O-F-F, in case you're wondering, D-Y-E-R. His latest book, Another Great Day at Sea, Life Aboard the USS George H.W. Bush. You comment on the abundance of acronyms that are used on a carrier. What is a COD? I always thought it was something to do with the postal service.
Yeah, the code. I think it's Carrier Onboard Delivery. Mm-hmm. Something like, yeah, it is. It certainly was the most AIE I've ever been, the most acronym-intensive environment I've ever been.
Did you understand it half the time when they were using the acronyms?
The acronyms are sometimes quite easy to figure out, but I don't think I've ever been in a place where I was experiencing so much that I didn't understand.
You say that you've never known anything like the suddenness of the change when you arrived. Isn't every flight like that? You leave snowy New York and arrive in the bright sunshine of the Caribbean.
It is sort of like that compared with the days when it would take you 8 weeks to go by ship. But bear in mind what happens. You know, the plane descends rather slowly. It taxis along the runway. You're getting filled with impatience. You have to go through immigration. You have to pick up your bags. And then you emerge into the new place. This, on the other hand, you come to a stop in a couple of seconds. The door winches down on the back. And there you are. You're in this absolutely other world.
What does it smell like?
Oh, it smells... So you're in the middle of the lovely, beautiful Arabian Gulf, and it smells like being in a garage with sort of 50,000 cars, each of which is suffering a major fuel leak.
But still, they're allowed to smoke.
Only on one very, very little bit of the aircraft carrier. And the photographer, he's very, very diligent. He went to take a picture there, and I said, you know, it just sounds so squalid. I don't want to go out there. You just tell me what it was like.
What are they doing? Hasn't it been argued that we really don't need all the aircraft carriers we have because we're in this post-Cold War environment?
Well, you're absolutely right. There's that question mark. And when you're on the, you know, you could look at the figures now and see how much it costs. When you're on the carrier, you get such a sense of this is a really, really incredibly expensive business. So there is, irrespective of the military, you know, whatever they're doing, it, you know, it would be good for people to think, is this really how we want our money spent? Not just in terms of the colossal cost of constructing these things, the boat and the planes, but the day-to-day cost of running it.
This is, I'm assuming, a fairly new aircraft carrier. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called the George H.W. Bush. But you have to wonder why that name. He isn't the most respected of all the presidents we've ever had. Were they just running out of presidents? Is there a Jimmy Carter?
That's a good question. I'm not sure there is. I imagine they're just sort of working there. There's a bit jokey bit in the book, though, where I say, I quote a bit of Walt Whitman. I said, why don't they just rename them after poets? Why not have the, you know, the USS Emily Dickinson? You know, partly because whereas there was a time when the military just wanted to emphasize its ability to conquer people, now a great deal of emphasis, in order partly to justify the existence of the carriers, is put on all the work they can do in terms of disaster management. So we hear, you know, we're familiar with these stories of, I think it was the USS Reagan that sailed to Japan after the tsunami and the Fukushima meltdown.
You expected to see ping pong tables and maybe even a tennis court. You brought your own ping pong paddle, didn't you?
Well, everybody had told me how huge aircraft carrier were, and you know, this one certainly was. It was vast. What I hadn't realized, perhaps stupidly, that with 70 aircraft on board and 5,000 crew members, it's incredibly crowded. So it was ridiculous of me, I realize now, to have thought there might be a tennis court. It's still a source of astonishment to me that there weren't two ping pong tables.
There is no alcohol allowed.
Yeah, there is on British and Australian aircraft carriers. Well, ships.
You said there were no British aircraft
carriers. You've cross-examined me, and you've caught me in a contradiction. Were there an aircraft carrier, a British aircraft carrier, there would be booze on board, and that also seemed crazy to me, because you know there's. I mean, people are working incredibly long days. So for one thing, they actually haven't got the time to go sort of boozing at night.
Although there is a Starbucks on board, or the equivalent of a Starbucks?
There's a little Starbucks concession, but like it, because there aren't many opportunities for sort of nice things, either it seemed to be shut or there was always a huge line to get in there. So I never sampled the shipboard Starbucks.
When there are that many people, there has to be some tension. What was your impression of the atmosphere in terms of religion? Were there people proselytizing?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. There's 5,000 people all crammed together. And one of the things that I noticed is that in stark contrast to the kind of Captain Bligh on the mutiny, on the bounty idea of, you know, a strict discipline, great premium is put on courtesy, politeness and that kind of stuff. Because, of course, that just eases social interactions. It became apparent to me after a very short time that it was an intensely religious boat, an intensely evangelical Christian ship.
So what happens if you are not a believer or you are of a different religion? Do you just simply have to disappear when certain things are being said?
No, when they first showed me the chapel or place of worship or whatever, they emphasized that although I was seeing it in its incarnation as a place for Pentecostal whatever, they said tomorrow it could be a synagogue or the day after it could be a Buddhist temple. So it's theoretically a broad church which just happens to be occupied for 90% of the time with, you know, straight down the line Christianity.
What about the food?
Well, I need to emphasize the problems with the food were mainly mine. A guy on the boat said, you know, a lot of the people on the ship, they eat better here than they do at home. But I'm a very, very fussy eater, and I wasn't crazy about the food. But then, you know, it's not going to be great organically grown kind of, there's no farmer's market down the road, this kind of stuff. It's, you know, it's mass catering in a really quite difficult environment.
Weren't you told a story about a disease that was spread among the men through a shared serving implement?
Just before I got on board, there'd been an outbreak of what they called the Bahrain bug, this kind of stomach flu or kind of dysentery, a diarrhea outbreak. And they contain this in a very, very simple way. Normally, at the lunch places, dinner places, you serve yourself from the kind of buffet, and they just turn the spoons around so that the kitchen staff serve people, and that apparently cauterized the spread of this bug, which I was very happy not to witness.
You also describe a number of awful accidents that are possible around planes taking off and landing. Is it true that you can see some of them on YouTube?
Yeah, you know, there's, I think there was this great phrase, because it's so inherently dangerous, an aircraft carrier, that they've taken all sorts of steps to make it, I can't remember the phrase the guy used, something like that, it's the safest, most dangerous place on Earth. But as they said, you know, they've arrived at these procedures through a lot, you know, through lessons of blood. And you can see on YouTube, I'd heard the story of a guy, and you can see it on YouTube, a guy getting sucked into the air intake of a jet.
Just one more thing. Do you think that they had a sense of mission, or were they just spending the time that they had to spend while they were in the military?
Oh, Lord. They may have joined up just because it was the best choice available, but they had absolutely a sense of mission and of service.
Jeff Dyer will be speaking with Paul Holden Graber at the 42nd Street Library tonight at 7 o'clock. Then tomorrow he'll be giving a reading and signing books at 7:30 at Word in Jersey City. For more details, go to our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Another Great Day at Sea, Life Aboard the USS George H.W. Bush, published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Oh, thank you, Leonard.